This is chapter 2, hello. And this is Thaddeus Lawrence Runaway Success. He, as I shared in the earlier video also, he ran 4 deserts, coldest, humidest, and warmest, and the Gobi Desert. So we'll be studying about the Gobi Desert, which is called as the Oven. So let us start reading about the desert. So the chapter 3, Gobi, the Oven, facing to finish. 27 June to 3rd July 2010. There are those days in life that just stick out in our mind. They are the ones that our brain files under its bookmarks or favorites to become indelible memories. These may be glorious moments worthy of a lifetime of celebration and reminiscence, or harrowing times to be so awful they leave an immemorial mark. Stage 4 of the Gobi March is one of those latter days. The ominous name of this stage, Flaming Mountains, give us a clue of what to expect of this relatively short 36-kilometer section that takes us into the heart of the Turpan Basin. Covering an area of 50,000 square kilometers, the Turpan Basin is the second lowest exposed place on Earth. It is surrounded by mountain ranges, including the central Tian Shan, and has a very terrain of salt flats, sand dunes, pioneers, and places. But who betide anyone who makes light of this beautiful region? Its hot and arid continental climate has earned it the potent moniker, the Oven. The previous stage ends in an Uyghur village where the icy cold waters of a river provide much relief for our aching muscles and a heavenly opportunity to rinse out clothing. Because of the long daylight hours, we treat ourselves to an extended lounge and soak in the tranquility of the area. It is a positively divine and does wonders for our spirits. The villagers have generously opened up their homes for us to spend the night, and the relative luxury of sleeping on a rug-lined floor in one that we all relish. I fervently hope that it will be warmer this evening after the bone-rattling chill of the previous 2 nights. But good things come with a price. Dusk brings news from the race organizers that buses will take us for an hour-long ride to the start line of stage 4 in the morning. Departure time is 4 a.m., which means getting up at 2:30 a.m. to check and pack our gear, make and eat breakfast, and do any last-minute preparations. How wonderful! There are rumblings of discontent. Some bemoan the early start. Others shake their heads at the idea of having to be transported to a different start line. To make matters worse, stifling heat, be careful what you ask for. Bleating goats and the late night revelry of our hosts make for a poor night's sleep. In the blackness of the morning, my body protests at being dragged out of bed. It sulks silently through breakfast, and I have to force feed myself the necessary calories in between yawns. Before long, we bound the waiting buses and police motorcycle outriders escort us to our destination. Were it not for my disquieting anticipation of the day's course and a discomforting bloated stomach, I would have released the VIP treatment. A local mayor is over the moon that an international cast of athletes has chosen his region to pit themselves against one another in a mad race. He is only too willing to accommodate us and make sure that our stay is a smooth one.
At the start line, the piercing light of over 150 head torches puncture the darkness to reveal the famous grape vineyards of the Turpan. Amid the cacophony of voices and reverberating sounds of the river, I search for a pocket of mental space to clear my head. I do not feel right. The early morning rise and bland breakfast do not sit well with me, and I am suffering the effects of yet another sleepless night. Feeling more than a little irate, I am also troubled by a nagging sense of something being out of place. I cannot quite put my finger on what it is, but I am not looking forward to this stage. Although tiring, the early start does afford some bearable temperatures of the first couple of hours to checkpoint one. The 13.5 kilometers takes place mostly along dirt, rock, and gravel tracks used primarily by earth movers and big lorries transporting sand. These and the electricity pylons stretching into the distance are the only signs of human life in a desolate region. The lack of gradient and relatively cool air are an advantage, but my legs just refuse to get going properly, and I struggle at a less than decent pace. Well before 9 a.m., I am forced to tuck into my 11s, hoping that the Japanese rice crackers and bakwa will improve my morale somewhat. They do, and I stroll into checkpoint. I am at checkpoint one, my spirit slowly rising with the sun. After the first checkpoint, the ground begins to change and the desert proper begins. I manage to put behind my earlier sluggishness and pick up momentum with about 5 kilometers of steady running. This is my best period of the entire day as I skip along the exchange banner with other competitors, smiling my effervescent smile. I am going at a good clip and eager to make up for the lost time. It seems like I have put the worst of a poor start and morning behind me, and the day will only get better from here on. I am about to be proved spectacularly wrong. Heat takes its toll. Halfway into the section, the sand dunes hit, and they hit with a fury. A series of never-ending dunes beginning with a massive sand hill, followed by a succession of smaller ones that keep going up and up and up. They suck my breath away, and I feel as if I am being punished for my earlier exuberance. The view of red scorched earth all around us must be arresting, but I am not in a state to appreciate it. The sun is now at its zenith and will stay there for the next several hours. Meanwhile, the still air hovers like a heavy cotton, dampening my mood. Its dryness sucking precious moisture from my body. It is beginning to be clear why this region is nicknamed the oven. My mind wanders briefly to home, and I flirt with the fantasy of tucking into a hearty home-cooked spread. But the daydream is brief. I'm yanked back to reality by the furious protest of my leg muscles. They force me to slow to a labored crawl. Somehow I manage to collapse into a checkpoint two, gasping for breath. I am not the only one in agony. For the first time in this race, I see competitor take a lengthy rest at a checkpoint. We hope that the terrain ahead will be a little more forgiving. But our real problems are only just beginning. The final section to camp is accurately rated as difficult, but no one could have anticipated what lay ahead for us. Leaving checkpoint two, the route continues upward across an open plain of soft and hardened sand, and then winds its way steeply up a wind-blasted mountain. From here, we have to repeatedly climb down and back up tight valleys until we eventually descend into hell. As someone would later describe it, imagine a funnel, and you are at the bottom where the sandy track is about a meter wide, and the sheer walls of the funnel are about two stories tall. We are in the windless gullies where the bases of mountains of rock come together to form a tight trough that goes on and on and on. We have no idea where we are and how long the maze of zigzag gullies goes on for. The only way out is to follow the path marked by the pink markers. Good luck to those who miss a marker and take a wrong turn. The front runners would have arrived here at the best part of the day, early enough to enjoy some shade. For the rest of us here, when the sun is glaring its hottest, we bear the brunt of its brutality. There is no respite from the torrid heat and not a silver of shade. The hot air bounces off the narrow walls and creates a tunnel of simmering, scorching atmosphere. It is a heat trap and we are literally baking. People are getting into all sorts of trouble and distress. I pass competitors being sick and vomiting. Some have run out of water and are severely dehydrated. Others are dizzy from heat exhaustion and slurring. This is a sure sign of heat stroke. It is getting serious out here. The problem is further compounded by the fact that there is no knowing how far we are from the end. The deep maze of gullies seem to go on forever, and the winding path turn left or right every few meters. It is enough to induce claustrophobia, generate an evolutionary fear of being trapped, and drive anyone mad. I speed up occasionally, not so much to change race tactics as to hurriedly flee the place. My attempts are desperate and wild. There is no end in sight and no way out. It is a terrifying 2.5 hours. Camp, when it finally arrives, is an old museum. Think giant sandcastle. Aptly named Uyghur Ghost Town. The whole place resembles a prisoner of war camp. A field hospital and a disaster response control center all roll into one. The walking wounded are everywhere. After 3 days of dealing with nothing more than blisters and scrapes, the doctors are literally rushed off their feet, scrambling up the mountain to give medical help and administer intravenous drips to those in serious danger. Volunteers are similarly in full rescue mode, frantically filling backpacks with bottles of extra water to bring up to the strugglers. 10 hours into the race and in temperature dipping 45 degrees Celsius, there are still competitors out on the course and out of water. Things do not look good at all. News of an emergency evacuation filters through. This changes the whole tone of the race. We huddle to talk, but without concrete facts or official announcements. Our information is mere conjecture. Who is the competitor? Is he conscious? Why is there no communication from the staff? Tensions run high, and our speculation seems to compound the magnitude of the problem, so I decide to abstain from further stirring the pot. I chat in hushed tones with Patrick, a Hong Kong-based Singaporean, and we decide to spend our energy replenishing our fluids instead. We agree that if the years serving our national service in the Singapore Army had taught us anything, it is the usefulness of the water parade and powder shower. A water parade is where soldiers assemble and drink a whole water bottle of water. Come to think of it, the scene resembles that of a Chinese wedding dinner. Only instead of downing mugs of beer or glasses of whiskey, we quaff water. The powder shower takes place out in the field, and the absence of water to shower in, we liberally sprinkle deep heat powder in an effort to crop heat rashes. In the midst of our uneasiness emerges the tremendous Esprit de Corps, for which such races have earned a reputation. People gather at different lookout points to keep an eye out for those yet to return. Others offer to head back out onto the course. We deliver first aid equipment and water. Many more say a silent prayer. The entire afternoon seems to drag on forever, and I head to the media tent to read emails from home. Their innocent messages uplift me. I can feel their energy and joy. They tell me there that whatever happens, I am already a hero in their eyes. They tell me how proud they are of me. I suppress a few tears. I needed to hear that. My spirits need fortifying more so than ever before. I value the love that is being sent me from afar, from my parents, girlfriend, friends, colleagues, and even strangers. I am moved that through all these, there are people who have me in their thoughts and hearts. I am choked up feeling their words of encouragement and faith in me. I thank God for them and for delivering me safely into camp. I know it could so easily be me still out on the course and in a far worse condition. As the remaining competitors stumble into camp, they are each applauded into a standing ovation. A few tears are shed and hugs linger. To spend 13 or 14 hours out on a hellish course in such appalling conditions takes monumental strength of spirit and lion hearts. Anyone bearing witness to this scene of elite athletes and fully grown adults displaying their emotions and coming together as one cannot help but be moved to salute the tenderness of the human nature. Many of us spend the night sleeping outdoors as a reprieve from the heat. I am more than a little worse for wear, but apart from exhaustion, I am mentally recovering from the unnerving episode in the gullies. The dazzling stars and the magnificent sand cliffs fail to lift the sense of disquiet and foreboding. I question my own mortality and safety. It is a sobering thought, and for the first time, it fully dawns up on me that what we are doing out here is extremely dangerous. The afternoon's demoralizing setback helps to focus my mind. A tragedy can so easily befall anyone at any time. This is no place for a cavalier attitude. I vow not to take any unnecessary gambles and be more attuned to the signals and feedback from my body. It is this and other apprehensive thoughts about what lies in store for us tomorrow that occupy my fragile mind as I drift into an uneasy sleep. Wake up call. Stage 5, top the long stage, does not get off to the best of starts. We are informed of a 6 a.m. flag off, which means waking at 4 a.m. Barely an hour to race start, and in the middle of breakfast, we are told that we may as well go back to bed because the start has been pushed back to 8 a.m. I am not a happy bunny and immensely frustrated. I could have done with that extra sleep, but my bags are already packed and I now have to recalibrate my food consumption since the calories already consumed at breakfast would not take me through to the afternoon. I plop down on the cold concrete and shut my eyes for another hour, fully dressed in my gear and shoes. The cumulative miles and the unforgiving heat have by now taken their toll, and fragile emotions are on the verge of boiling over. At a somber morning briefing, we are informed that the rescued competitor yesterday has fallen into a coma and is under intensive care in the local hospital. It appears he had started the day with a couple of companions but decided to push on through the stage without them when they opted for a break. It was much later when someone came across him alone and in great discomfort. There is nothing that we can do for him except pray for a full recovery. This is not the kind of announcement we wanted to see us off on the 99-kilometer long stage. We take in the news and many of us decide for safety's sake to take on the stage in groups or pairs. Fortunately, the weather is kind and the hot spell relents. The entire morning is overcast, almost unheard of at this time of year. At one point, I even felt a drop of rain or two. The tension of the previous day dissolves into the cloudy morning as we quickly shrug off our heavy parts and launch into the day. The route takes us almost immediately across the series of fast-moving streams into deep, muddy ditches, through tall bamboo groves and onto rocky sand cliffs. This is followed by several hours of weaving through an Uyghur town and some Han villages, a welcome change from the vast openness of the plains and any one of recent days. Pretty much the entire local population has turned out to line the streets, and we exchange countless high fives with identical looking boys with their ubiquitous crew cut hairstyles and football jerseys. The girls sit next to good-natured elders and beam their sweet, shy smiles. Then it is out along the ancient silk route, past trading posts of beautiful stone and mud brick ruins, beside irrigated fields. The sun is somewhat forgiving during this first half of the day, but the wind is not. The lethal breeze dries our sweat instantaneously. While making the heat bearable, it also means we have no conscious idea of how hard our body is working to cool itself. If not monitored properly, we could be in danger of serious dehydration. All is going cheerily, smooth, and soon we leave the hubbub of town and hit back onto rocky, sandy, and salt-encrusted earth, into the second lowest point of earth. The dreary landscape has the effect of accentuating boredom and heightening the physical burden. When we get to checkpoint 3, the medical crew prohibits my companion Dave O'Brien from proceeding any further until they check his urine. He has not relieved himself since yesterday, and the doctors want to be sure that there is nothing out of order with his kidneys. As I depart, he is chugging down water to fill his bladder. He is a trooper, and I am sure he will be up and running once he gets the all clear. It feels like we are in godforsaken, windswept middle of nowhere. Competitor Ricky Pock describes the place in his blog. From 30 kilometers to 50 kilometers, the course took us through the Turpan Basin and the town of Turpan. Turpan has the distinction of being further away from a main body of water than any other place on earth. It was dry, hot, and every imaginable shade of brown. There is nothing in Turpan except for dirt. You can stop by the dirt cafe for a dirt sandwich and wash it down with a glass of dirt. Daily course undoubtedly revolve around shoveling and moving said dirt. Regardless, I started to feel worse for wear in between this stretch in all of its uninspiring glory. There is nothing but brown, crusty mounds and iridescent brine pools as far as the eye can see. Someone described it as though heads had plowed the surface and left it to bake for centuries. Suddenly, as if God was listening to our thoughts, the overcast skies dissipate and a clear blue sky with a very hot sun beats down on us. The sweetness and severity of the change is dramatic. Within the space of half an hour, the temperature soars several degrees and it feels like someone has turned on the heating grills around us. The few competitors I see along the way have their heads down and appear to be in a hypnotic state. Soon I too am diminished into an apathetic torpor. My heavy legs are on autopilot mode and all I hear is the monotonous sound of my footsteps. Even my usually occupied mind has drained itself of thoughts. I unconsciously start to bang an empty water bottle against my thigh. The echoing sound, a reassuring, urging rhythm. It is close to 10 p.m. when I arrive at checkpoint 6, just in time to watch the sunset on the horizon. A crimson fireball sinking piecemeal onto the purple darkness. The volunteers here are untiring, their inexhaustible energy exuding untold optimism. They have to, for this is the tent for the ailing. Two competitors are laid up on the stretchers in a deep sleep. IV drips, supplying much needed sustenance into their placid bodies. Three women were poring over their ravaged feet while a couple of men are just about done retching and throwing up. As I recoil from the horror around me, a Japanese competitor lurches into the tent, wide eyed and breathless with anxiety and apprehension. He tries to speak in between heaving breaths, but the doctor calms him down enough to extract that she needs to know. Someone is in a bad way not far from the checkpoint and is clearly in need of medical attention. With that, she grabs her medical kit and bounds into a four-wheel drive, a rescue damsel to the distressed. I'm surprised not so much at what is happening, but at who have landed themselves in the precarious situation. I glanced around these at the poorly ones and find them unfamiliar. That means only one thing. They are the stronger ones who have been miles ahead of me all this time. I am fearful and comforted at the same time. Afraid because if such seasoned and well-trained athletes can end up over the age, then what more an amateur like myself? Yet I find consolation in my conservative and plodding pace. At least I stay alive and keep myself in one piece, I justify to myself. In the dark, I prepare to push on. I am looking forward to get to checkpoint 7, the overnight stop where hot water is available and makeshift tents are set up for those who wish to get some kip. Every four deserts race has such a designated overnight checkpoint. As long as they are within the cutoff times, competitors may choose to have a hot dinner and rest up for a while before continuing on. I am thankful for the company of Aussie competitor Linda Dable, and together we set off into the night. Nightfall brings with it additional challenges, and having someone alongside me raises my confidence and self-assurance. With our headlamp beams providing the only source of light, our eyes are firmly on the ground to watch where we are going. But due to parallax error, which is the change in the apparent position of an object when the position of the observer changes, it is the nightmare trying to estimate depth and distance, especially when on uneven, rugged ground. In my bumbling tiredness, I feel as if I am pummeling my feet into the hard earth with every step. It is excruciating on my knees, and I curse under my breath at my unsteadiness. To make matters worse, we keep losing sight of the markers and glow sticks. Either the organizers have placed them too far apart, or the lay of the land has shielded them from our sight, or we are simply not paying enough attention to where we are going. In any case, it is disconcerting having to constantly break out stride, the sky, and scan all around for the minute neon sign that assures us we are on the right track. Sometimes we even have to run off in several different directions to look. Not only does it lose us precious time, it wastes valuable energy, increases our distance, and piles on enormous stress on our already fragile states. The very thought of having to wait till daybreak to shed light on our location, or worse, being completely lost in the middle of nowhere, spurs us on, those and a grumbling stomach hankering for some hot food. We near a town, and this spells both good and bad news. Good because this indicates we are near the checkpoint. Bad because the local children are fond of the glow sticks and will abscond with them at the slightest opportunity. Whenever the organizers get wind of this, they remark the course. This then leads to another round of filtering, and the entire circle replaces itself. The mischievous fellows have also been known to replant the markers, scattering competitors in all sorts of wrong directions. Rascals. When we finally get into the checkpoint 7, all I can do is drop myself down and wolf down dinner. I do not even wait for the freeze-dried food to fully rehydrate. The crunch adds a little al dente texture to my meal. I somehow manage to drag my lifeless body to one of the two standing tents and promptly fall asleep. It is the deepest sleep I have had all weeks, and I am out like a light for the next 3 hours. I open my eyes and instantly know I have overslept. The soft golden glow of the morning lines the horizon. The look around and realize that I had not bothered to use my sleeping bag, and I am lying in an awkward position on the floor of the tent. I hear a familiar voice, Patrick. I had started the day with my competitor, but after the first checkpoint, had powered ahead and left me in his dust. I imagined he must have been close to finishing the stage by now, but there he is on the other side of the tent. We link up with Brighton Steve Rhodes, and together we set off for the final 23 kilometers to camp. Resting up for a few hours always brings much relief, but there is a huge downside. My body screams blue model and refuses to get moving again. My muscles have turned to lead and seized up. My joints creak and burn in red-hot agony. It is excruciating to restart the engine and get going again. And as soon as we limp back onto the trail, I begin to lag behind my companions. I know I'm a slow starter, so I let things be. While I'm grateful that the others slow down to accommodate me, I hope I'm not hindering their progress too much. When I have my sight set on a goal and am advancing towards it, anything and anyone not in full alignment is an obstacle that must be overcome. For this reason, I hate being a liability myself and holding people back. At this point, I clearly have a lot to learn, and it would take the rest of the Four Desert series to teach me compassion and gentleness with others and myself. The crisp coolness of dawn gives way rapidly to blazing hotness, and we brace ourselves for another day of scorching conditions. I try not to think about the pain and the hours ahead. It helps that my camera has run out of battery. I feel relieved of the self-imposed burden of taking scenic snapshots and compiling visual stories of my race. Too much time is often spent snapping pictures for posterity at the expense of fully being at the moon in the moment. If people want to see what the Gobi looks like, they can jolly well sign up for the next endurance race. I switch my mind and body to autopilot and trudge on. We are still within the cut of time, but are eager to make it to camp before the sun reaches its zenith. Hong Konger Barry Chen joins us, and our hearts collectively sink when we realize where we are headed. Soon to tower over the four of us is a formidable wall of sand. Over the last hour, we have been heading straight for this imposing chain of sand dunes, a crease of light brown along the horizon. With each closer step, we make out snaking lines, which turn out to be the distant footprints of competitors who have gone before us. Even now, as we peer closely, we can see the tiny black dots of people plodding their way through this one last barrier before camp. That there is an additional makeshift checkpoint doling our extra water passage, our looming test. 5 kilometers in a short distance, but 5 kilometers of sand dunes in 50 degrees Celsius with blistered feet after over 230 kilometers in the previous 5 days in varying stages of exhaustion and dehydration can be the straw that breaks the camel's back. The sun beats on us from above and reflects off the ground for a more complete incineration. The sand is so hot, it breaks right through the soles of my trail shoes and my double-layered socks. So this is what walking on fire feels like. The water in my water bottle is only just short of scalding. From time to time, God turns on the hair dryer and whips it across our faces. I'm not sure which is worse. To navigate the dunes in the night with fading torches and risk getting lost, or being in the blistering vehemence of the day and risk running out of water. Next to drowning, being passed to death must be the worst way to die. Sand dunes are exactly as you imagine them to be, soft and powdery, deep and sinking. It is easier, almost fun, to go down them, and I let gravity do the job. Going up is the opposite, a strenuous, painstaking toil that torments every leg muscle. Every step up is followed with a half-step backslide. It is imperative to think ahead, for going down the wrong dune and can lead to a long way back up. The key is to work together as a team and scout out the best route forward. In this respect, we perform admirably. As Barry suffers the effects of dehydration, he unselfishly urges us ahead. Patrick should have done of it, would have none of it, and offers to hang back with him. So Steve and I lead the charge, and we follow slightly separate routes. At the top of each ridge, the footsteps of dozens of racers spread out before our eyes. By and large, they follow the same path, but occasionally we see evidence of someone or a group attempting a different and hopefully easier bearing. By tracing their footsteps with our eyes, we can see whether they evenly converge or veer off in different directions. And by studying their movements and trying to think two steps ahead, we can make a judgment call on which set of footprints to follow based on what seems the less taxing. The formula here is not so much to minimize time or distance, but to minimize climb and save energy. To this end, we sometimes succeed and sometimes fail. Each time Steve and I get to the top of the next ridge, we turn around and signal to the other two the better route to follow. This way, we get to ensure that Barry and Patrick always succeed.